Hello, everyone. This is your co-host, Stu, and I'm here with the paranormalist, Patty Wilson. Patty, how are you this incredibly warm and lovely spring day?
I am doing really well. Thank you for asking. And you?
Also very well. A little sore. Had to do a lot of yard work today, at least on the dry parts of my lawn. There are places where, I mean, I joked to you before, I don't know whether to plant rice or cranberries. And I think the Pennsylvania Fish Commission was eyeballing my yard as they drove by, too. So
you might have needed it stocked.
Mm-hmm. So maybe. Anywho, if you are new to the podcast, we thank you for joining us. Thank you for finding us. And we hope you'll stick around for further episodes. If you are an old hat coming back, I was throwing around the term paranormalian. And I don't know if we discussed a little bit of a name to call our cadre of listeners, but maybe we'll open that up at another juncture. But anyway, if you are one of those unnamed cadre of listeners, everything about this podcast will be down in the description down below, in the information, whether you're on video or audio. And I think I have nothing else to say. No, that's about it. Okay. And our topic for today
is voodoo.
I'm sorry?
Voodoo.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry. Yeah, there was just a little bit of a Skype there.
That's okay. Mm-hmm. So, a while back, I did do an episode on voodoo. And this is a completely different type of episode. So it's not about the mythology so much as it is about how it portrays itself in the lives of people. So a very quick history. So voodoo, V-O-D-O-U, dates back to about 6,000 years in Africa. So whenever the slaves were brought out of Africa into Haiti and the West Indies and all of that, they brought with them their customs, their cultures, and what have you. They were brought by the Spanish and the French most of the time. That was the vast majority of them were brought by those two particular countries. And they were slaves, along with people from other ethnicities. People don't talk about it very much, but there were Irish and there were other Europeans, Slovakians, what have you. So this group of people all became slaves, and they brought with them a melting pot of beliefs and traditions and religions that gradually become homogenized and then blended into Christianity. So, you know, the Roman Catholic Church is the church that basically proselytized and converted many of the slaves of whatever their nationality. So in order to make this work, this new faith, which is completely new and it's in many ways, voodoo, as we know it today, becomes born. And it takes pagan ideas such as polytheism, which is many gods, and merges it with the Christian idea in the Catholic Church of saints and of gods and ghosts and spirits called Iowa. And all of this becomes this amalgam that then becomes shaped into what we know as modern voodoo, which will then spin off into Santeria and a bunch of other variations on the theme over the course of time. Each of them getting a little more virulent or dangerous in some respects than the original one, although the original one's quite dark. So I wanted to sort of talk a little bit about the history of it and offer some interesting stories all the way from an early voodoo story all the way up to today, because believe it or not, voodoo is now practiced in almost every country in the world, most likely every country, at least to some extent.
Wow.
Over approximately half of people in that Native Haitians are involved in the voodoo, and a lot of them don't see a problem with practicing voodoo and also practicing Catholicism. They married the two almost seamlessly. So that's it is something that has traveled, and it traveled to the United States with slavery. in a large part, because, and there they pulled in other ideas from the Native American cultures and the Dutch and everybody else that was here. And again, it became a melting pot. So it's the same and different in a lot of respects. And we think of voodoo in some foreign land like Haiti and, you know, a bunch of people dancing at midnight and, you know, all of that. And yep, that stuff happens, and the dead chickens and all of that. But it has virulent forms in many other places. So I'm going to start you with a story of voodoo. And one of the ways it cross-pollinated into other cultures, because this particular story is very much about that. So this story starts in the mid-1700s. It's about a woman, a white woman, who becomes known regionally as a voodoo priestess. The place is Jamaica, and the woman is a very, very beautiful young white girl. She was born there or brought very shortly after birth by her immigrant parents. In this instance, they were British and Irish. The father was British, the mother was Irish, and they immigrated to Jamaica. Today, that doesn't maybe make as much sense as it will whenever I'm finished with it. So we need to understand that the West Indies and Jamaica and the whole of that region were very, very desirable for Europeans. And there were a lot of people who came as poor immigrants hoping to find work or make a living in those regions, because sugar cane was a vast trade. It was one of the most lucrative trades in the world at the time, raising sugar cane and selling the sugar product. So there were shipping companies, there were packing companies, there were tons of jobs, you know, clerking, all of these things, being a sailor or a captain, all of these jobs pertained to that. So poor Europeans that had no prospects where they were at would come to these countries applying for work. And that's what happened with this young lady. Her family came there seeking a better life. And according to everything, well, we'll see how she fared, we'll say. So the young woman came to a place called Rose Hall Great House, or Rose Hall Plantation, or just Rose Hall, at the age of 18. It was in Montego Bay, Jamaica, and it was a Georgian ornate style mansion. It was built by her soon-to-be husband. She fell in love with the house and, to be honest with you, probably with the riches. The building was so luxurious. It had silk wallpaper, chandeliers in every room, you know, 15-foot high ceilings. It was just an amazing place. The gentleman she married was a man by the name of John Palmer, who built the house. She immediately fell in love with him, supposedly, and married him. But as stories go, unfortunately, her name was Annie Patterson, her maiden name, and she becomes, you know, Annie, and she marries Mr. Palmer, Annie Palmer. And very shortly after the marriage, things start to kind of go downhill. They just don't work out well for her. The honeymoon, you know, doesn't last very long. And she would say, the locals would say it was because of constant abuse and infidelity. Now, Annie is the one who did both.
Oh, okay.
Everybody was like looking at poor old John Palmer, but there's only one known instance of John Palmer raising a hand to her. And although it's her right, I mean, there is some mitigating forces at play in this instance. So Annie would take lovers all the time. She obviously didn't care for John Palmer. And including among the lovers were slave men at the plantation. And supposedly, one day John Palmer caught her in one of her trysts. And in anger, he beat her very badly for cheating on her. What he did not know is that Annie had spent most of her childhood learning from her nanny, who was a woman from Haiti, about voodoo. And so she practiced it secretly, keeping it very quiet and close to the vest, because it would have been frowned upon by the Christian counterpart particularly the non-Catholics who were Christians. They would have spoken ill of her, and she recognized that, and she needed a good match in order to climb up the societal ladder. So she hadn't said anything about it, and she would do it in private. Things would get very quickly out of hand, and she was furious at being caught. She was furious at being beaten. She was furious because he put a plan in play that she would no longer be allowed to cultivate relationships among the servants or even among his friends, because he took care of that situation as best he could. And he thought he was going to have to deal with this for the rest of his life. And unfortunately, it wasn't a long one. He died very shortly thereafter. There were those that knew her well, some of the Black servants who had kind of participated in helping her hide her efforts in voodoo, because they didn't want to get killed. They didn't trust her, a white woman who was a voodoo priestess. This was really scary to them. She had all the power in both realms now. She physically could hold the power over them because they were her slaves. And spiritually, she understood their culture better than they did in a lot of respects. So she could cast spells, she could poison them, she could do all kinds of things. And she recognized really quickly how powerful that made her. And her husband died within a couple weeks of finding her. The whispers begin across the plantation, and eventually it makes it from that plantation to the next plantation. You know how rumors and whispers go. But nobody could even look into his death, because upon his death, she inherited all his wealth, all his land holdings, and all his slaves. She was the richest woman in the entire region. So the entire nation. So there was nothing anybody could do about her. And everybody kind of had to look aside. So for quite a while, she continues on this way. She takes lovers, both white men and the Black slaves. She begins to become very sadistic and cruel. There were punishments for anybody who, and even in a minor way, infringed on her life or caused her any disgust or distress or anything. And she would have her slaves beaten. She would put spells on them and tell them they were going to die in a couple of days, and sure enough, they would die. But not only did the slaves have that issue, but white people across her started to have that issue as well. And everybody was terrified of her, everyone. And that fear kept her ruling for quite a while, until a series of events happened. One of the slaves that she goes after and she tortures had a family member who was at a different plantation on the same island. And he is not as afraid of her as everybody else is. So basically what he does is, he was a voodoo priest before he was captured. And he thinks he's stronger than her and that he can take her down. So he sets out to go after her. And he manages to, he says he's going to take her out and kill her. So everybody was saying, you can't do this. She's a white witch. You can't do this. She's too strong. But he doesn't believe that. But he says, I'm going to kill her. I'm going to strangle her. I'm going to put her in a coffin, bury it with concrete. I'm going to do magical spells to keep her spirit confined. And I got this. I know I can do this. And he sets out with a bunch of charms and different things to weaken her so she's not as strong as she should be. He succeeds. He weakens her enough that he can kill her, and he does. And he buries her with all the appropriate rickrack that he would need to keep her bound. But she doesn't stay bound. Either he miscalculated or she was stronger than he thought. So to this day, it is said she haunts Rose Hall. And it was ruined and derelict until it was purchased by one of Miss America's in the 1990s, and she rebuilt the place and redid it, and it's absolutely gorgeous. It's been completely restored to its historic grandeur, and you can tour it now. But people going there talk about different things. The first thing they talk about is the apparition of a woman on riding a spectral horse. She's always dressed in a green velvet riding costume. And I have to tell you, I cannot imagine wearing something like that in the type of tropic temperatures, but apparently this is what Annie wore. Others talk about inside the building, they'll see shadowy figures slipping along the walls. They hear noises and footsteps screaming out of empty rooms. And in the night, and you know, it just continues on and on. Now, there are some who will tell you that this woman is never this never happened. None of this happened. That this Annie was, Palmer wasn't a real person. But we know Palmer Mansion existed. We know he was married to a woman named Annie. And everything kind of came together in 1929 when a book was written about this Annie Palmer. And it was basically based on the fact that this guy went to Jamaica and he heard these stories. He found them interesting, so he romanticized them into a novel. But there's no doubt that the vast majority of the story is true. And there was an Annie Palmer. We do know that. We do know the events with John Palmer happened, that he died, and that she was caught in affairs with various men and all of that. But there has always been this argument by critics that, you know, you just took it and romanticized the White Witch, but the stories have been there for at least 200 years. So take them for what they are. But that's the classic kind of a voodoo story, a priestess who, you know, is very powerful, who lords over everybody and what have you. And as I said, it came to, you know, came back to the United States with people who worked in, you know, in Jamaica and Haiti and different places, also with the slaves coming over from those places. Like if you came straight from Africa, you wouldn't have been exposed to voodoo, because it's that amalgamation that makes it uniquely Haitian and Jamaican. But if you had been on those islands and you saw the practices playing out, then you would carry them with you when you got to, you know, to the Carolinas or wherever you ended up. So our next story is going to take place in Charleston in the late 1800s. For those who see Charleston today, it's a grand old city, but it's lost its luster. In its heyday, it was one of the busiest port cities in the world. People spoke literally dozens and dozens and dozens of languages, coming and going from all over. There were slaves and servants and all kinds of different things happening all at the same time. This was its own little world in the city. And so Charleston was the most bustling place you could imagine. In Charleston, there were voodoo practicers, not just servants and slaves, but people who came up in society, who made that leap from being a slave or a servant to being literally some of the most powerful people in the Charleston arena. So we're going to talk about one of those. There was a particular gentleman who made that leap. And when he did, he literally became the power of the entire city. He beat the mayor. He was the guy who controlled the police forces. He controlled everything because everybody was terrified of him. His name was John Domingo, and everybody locally called him the Black Constable because everything went through him. Now, there are so many stories of this guy that it's hard sometimes to pull pieces apart, but I'm going to tell you this. There is no doubt whatsoever that he was a real person. There's lots of letters, documents, what have you, throughout the Charleston history of people referring to him, talking to him, referencing him and his exploits. And believe me, he had exploits. He was a huge man. He was a little, his hair was always unruly. He always smelled a little, was always a little sweaty, but then it's Charleston. So I would imagine so was about a bunch of other people. And he wore this Union greatcoat, and he often looked like he was a vagabond. But when he stood up and he looked at you, you knew better. You definitely knew better. He could walk into a room and glance around, and the entire room would fall silent. He would go anywhere he chose, talk to anyone he chose, and nobody would buck him. So they say that he could control weather, like particularly the winds, and that merchants and sailors would go to him to pay him to protect them for safe passage whenever they started a voyage. And he would give them these charms and what have you, and tell them without these, the storm will come. And if they crossed him and refused to pay him, there are stories that those sailors didn't come back, if you get what I mean.
I got what you mean.
Yeah. He offered curses and love potions, and his entire life he could command whatever price he wanted for any of this stuff. He could heal people if he wanted. He could drive you to mental illness. He could give you diseases, and he could raise the dead. They said he had an army of zombies on his plantation, that the people that worked there weren't living people, but dead people, whom he had animated again so that he didn't have to pay them, because he had a plantation. He was that rich. And he had slaves, zombie slaves. And it was said anybody he so chose, he could turn into a zombie. There was no questions to be asked. So you can imagine how terribly powerful he was. There are stories that he was an African prince sold into slavery, that his name was High John de Marais, and that he was able to do all of this because of a ring that he wore in his hand. It was a ring that was the shape of a serpent, and it was made of silver, with the head coming up and a stone in the snake's mouth. And he never took it off. Not for one second, not ever. He said it was forged on the banks of the Congo River, that it was imbued by the power of demons, and he convinced everyone. He was the greatest voodoo priest in the entire state. Everybody quaked at his name. You can imagine, that's why they called him the Black Constable. Everyone, everything went through him. You could murder somebody, and if he told the police not to arrest you, you would walk. You could have done nothing, and if he told the police to take you, you would hang. So it is said that one day Domingo used his powers to catch two thieves, or two men who were robbing somebody, and he lifted one up in each of his great powerful hands, literally holding them above off the ground. And he said, "I will show you all how powerful I am." And as they were screaming and, you know, begging for mercy and what have you, he called out, "I am more powerful than the Iwa," which is the demon. "I am more powerful than your Jesus." And as he did this, suddenly he screamed, and both of the men fell out of his hands, and he grabbed his throat. And it is said that he was lifted off of his feet by something, no one knows which one, and strangled to death and thrown to the ground, where he began very quickly to writhe. And he became an emaciated husk of a man that turned to dust within seconds in front of all the horrified people who had gathered to see him do whatever he had planned to do to the two thieves. But as I said with Annie, apparently the whatever happened wasn't enough to keep him down. After his death, people claimed that they would see the Black Constable, would walk the nights, come out of the shadows. He would step out of cemeteries. He would even resurrect his powers at necromancy. They said he haunts old Charleston, that his house was demolished, and he became angrier even at that point. Eventually, like all things, his time was up, and he ceased. Or at least they say he ceased. But then again, if you're that powerful of a voodoo doctor, heaven only knows what you can do. I just thought that was a fascinating story. And I could see that I've done a little bit of research on Old Charleston for other reasons. And it was the kind of place where that kind of power could be swayed. Everything was done, with a wink, a nod, and there were only certain people behind the scenes who could be that powerful. The fact that he owned a plantation, that everybody of every nationality kowtowed to him, literally bowed when he walked in a room, tells you he had great power, or at least he was able to engender great fear. So he's quite a character, isn't he?
That would be one way of phrasing it, yeah.
So as voodoo comes forward into the 20th century, it comes a little different. Again, it's been an amalgam of things throughout the years. And so in the beginnings of the early 20th century, so the early 1900s, there are stories. In 1911, January of 1911, there was a police call to the residence of a man by the name of Walter Byers in West Crosby, Louisiana. People were kind of upset and worried because he hadn't shown up for work for a couple of days. And he never missed work. He was that kind of dedicated person. So the authorities went to his home and they found that everything was in order outside. They knocked and nobody answered. So they opened the door. It wasn't locked. And they went into the bedroom. And that's when everything changed. His bedroom was literally a bloodbath. His wife, himself, their six-year-old son were brutally murdered. They were butchered. There was blood everywhere. There was a bucket of blood, of their blood on the floor. They were hacked open by hatchet that was still laying on the floor. And it looked as though they'd all been killed in their sleep. There was no struggle. And the police said, oh, somebody came through the window. It was open and must have come in the middle of the night and struck this poor family down. The brutality spoke of somebody who had a great hatred for this man, except for the fact that there was nobody like that. Nobody in the entire area had any grudge against this man. He was known as being a kind, soft-spoken man, a hard-working man, a good family man. The police couldn't find anything. And they were hoping it would be a one-time deal. And as they were investigating, suddenly things get even crazier. The following month, there's another set of murders, just like this first one. Guy by the name of Alexander Andrus, his wife Minnie and their two young kids, all found the same way, hacked up in their beds, an axe laid on the, on the ground, covered in blood, a bucket of blood at the scene, mutilated terribly. The following month, another family, that of Alfred and Elizabeth Hathaway, and their three children. But this one's in San Antonio, Texas. But these are such grisly murders. The word spreads. It's across. And somebody says, I wonder if this has anything to do with that Byers murder. And they began to start talking, the police officers from the different sites. And they start putting their heads together and they're looking for something, similarities. What did Byers and Andrus and the Hathaway family have in common? Well, there were two things. They were poor and they were black. So now the police think they've got a handle. And they announce that they have a serial killer. This is one of the very first serial killings. And it's racially motivated, that they are looking for a rich white guy. And that totally screws them over because there isn't anybody that's ever seen or has any connection to. And they keep looking and looking and looking. And finally, they got a lead that from the mistress of a black fellow by the name of Raymond Barnabet. And she goes to the police and says, he scares me. He's been bragging. He killed that Andrus family. And he came home the following morning and he had blood on his clothes. And she says, and I think he might have done it. If he did them, he might have done them other ones too. I don't know. But he did tell me that he did that one. So they go and they arrest this man. He pleads his innocence. He had nothing to do with it, nothing whatsoever, he says at the beginning. And then his daughter, who's 17, comes to the trial. Her name is Clementine. And his son, Zephron. And they both say their dad had been abusive, that he had forced them to help get rid of the evidence of the murders, that they knew for a fact that he was the murderer. Now his mistress and his two teenage kids are speaking against him. He gets convicted, but he successfully wins an appeal to go back to trial. While he's in jail waiting for another trial, something happens that totally changes the game for everybody. There's another killing. It's November of 1911, and Norbert and Azima Randall are murdered with their four kids. Everything's exactly the same, except this time the man is shot in the chest, but everything else is the same. They're hacked to pieces and left there, a bucket of blood, the whole nine yards. Everything stays exactly the same. Now, people are speculating, and maybe this man woke up and they had to kill him quickly and then took their time on everybody else, or they'd already killed everybody else and he startled awake. Now, the police begin to look, because if he's in prison, how could he have done it? But his daughter and his son had information that they offered that convinced the police during that first trial that he was guilty. Things that they would only have known if they'd been at the crime scene, or they'd helped clean it up or clean up bodies afterwards or something. So now they start thinking, well, wait a second. If they was just cleaning up the bodies, or cleaning up the afterward, getting rid of the clothes and stuff like that from their dad, how would they know about the bucket of blood? How would they know about this? How would they know about that? So now they're looking at Clementine and her brother, and they're thinking, now, Clementine lived really close to the Randalls, and when they went the day after the murders to talk to her, there was blood on her door, and there was a paper at the crime scene that said, a complete suit of women's clothing, saturated with blood and covered with human brains. See if you can find it. Well, when they got there, they did find that outfit shoved in a closet hidden. Now, I have to tell you that my first thought, someone set her up. They start looking at the brother, but the brother has an airtight alibi. He was in a public place with a lot of people, and they all claim they saw him at the same time in the same spot. So now they arrest, but that didn't stop the killings. They intensify. January of 1912, three families were murdered in the same way in the same month. Bam, 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 one a week, 3 weeks. And at one of those scenes, there was a message in blood on the wall. When he maketh the inquisition for blood, he forgetteth not the cry of the humble, and signed by a group called the Human Five. The media posts this message, it's written in the newspapers, it goes everywhere, and somebody comes forward and says, I know what they are, they're a voodoo cult. And all this has been going on because they're sacrificing people. And they hide it under all the gore and stuff. Like if you just did the things that are just the ritual things, people would recognize it fairly quick. They talk to her, to Clementine, and she says, eventually she confesses. And she says, yep, that's exactly what it is. These are voodoo murders, and we call ourselves the Church of Sacrifice. And she tells them all this stuff. She tells them where they meet. None of this is proven. None of this can be proven. But she swears by every word that she says that they take the bodies, they will take the lives of these people so that they can achieve immortality. She says they use charms to protect themselves and conjure bags to get them into the house and to keep everybody asleep while they do the deed. That's why nobody ever woke up. And she tells this crazy story. She says, all total, they'd killed 35 people. The first few, they hadn't known enough to butcher them right, so it maybe didn't work, but the rest they did. She said, we meet in churches sanctified holy, Christ sanctified holy church in Lake Charles, Louisiana. But when they went there, the pastor's like, I have no clue what you're talking about, people. You're crazy. Come on in, take a look around the church, talk to anybody you want, blah, blah, blah. And they never did find anything in the church that had anything to do with it. However, because she confessed, and because at that point they realized that the murders could continue even if she was in jail, if there was other people, they were doing it to muddy the waters, so to speak. They put her on trial. She is convicted and ends up going to Angola State Prison in Baton Rouge. She was 19 years old. She doesn't get out until 1923. And they say when in the article about her being returned to society that that a mysterious procedure had cured her and restored her to sanity, stating that a voodoo ritual to release her spirit had been done. No more murders happened after she was convicted. Were the other people afraid to continue because they might be found out? Was the whole thing a lie? Were they voodoo murders seeking immortality? And if so, I wonder how they became immortal. She came down through history immortal, and her story will never be completely forgotten. But nobody knows who the other ones were, if there even were other ones. And that's an absolutely true story. You can read the newspaper articles. You can read the court trial transcripts. There's a lot of data. Two trials for him, one for her. Both ended up being convicted. And his conviction was not overturned. And that's where we're going to have to leave that story. But voodoo is definitely at the heart of it, or at least the ideas of voodoo, to create fear. I can't imagine a community more frightened than the communities in which those murders, as senseless as they were, had happened. So we're going to go to back to Haiti for a moment. In 1863, Congo Pelé of Haiti spoke to his sister Janine, who was a voodoo priestess, and he said he needed help to gain power and wealth. And she said, "I will help you, my brother." So they went and talked to very high priests on the island, and they were told that they needed to create a sacrifice of a goat without horns. Now, in the voodoo, that's a parlance for a human being.
Okay.
Without horns. So I know you all are thinking, well, you're just talking about a goat, but we're not just talking about a goat. We're talking about a human being. And so on December the 27th, Janine invited her sister to go to Port-au-Prince for the day. While they were out, Congo and the two priests kidnapped the sister's daughter, Clarissine. She was 12 years old. They hid her under the altar of the local church where they held sway. And I knew this was December 27th, so New Year's Eve is not far off, where they performed on New Year's Eve the murder. They strangled her. I won't go into all of it. They decapitated her. The blood was taken, and she was cannibalized. And that is as ungraphic as I can get it to let you know a little bit of what happened to that poor child. Shortly after that, they were all arrested. In open court, they all confessed to all the details. And on February the 13th of 1864, it is known, it is in the court records, that they were executed for the affair. However, there are people who will tell you that it wasn't because they were voodoo priests and priestesses, but rather because the then president of Haiti, President Giffard, was born a slave, was strongly pro-Catholic, and he wanted to move Haitian people away from voodoo to Christianity. And so they said he used this case to highlight the evils of voodoo. But there's nothing in any document that I've read that says that they weren't guilty, only that he used it to his advantage.
Imagine that, a politician using something to his advantage.
And this case was so well known, it made headlines all over the world, and it really did cement for all time that popular notion of voodoo. You know, in the dark at midnight with a dead chicken and the candles and that, because they describe it, and that's what's in the papers. And so it really does change the complexion of voodoo and make it much, much more dark. Yes, but yes, I just said, imagine a politician using something for his own advantage. But, using it for his advantage doesn't make it not happen. It just meant that he used it because it was already his. Now we're going to go forward into the 20th century further. In 1997, there was a guy by the name of Mark Foster. He was a CEO of a tech company, and he was found along the roadside in northeastern Wisconsin. He was dressed in all white clothing, and he had been shot. Mark had been known to be a voodoo practitioner, and he had his own little cult where he was the high priest, In the summer of 1997, he started to have financial issues, and his business began to kind of go downhill. It was at that time that he talked to one of his parishioners, Gregory Fessenaire, who he then said, "I think you you need to kill me. It is time for me to go." Now, there's a rationale to this. So Foster said he had been involved in order to become the voodoo priest he was. He had been involved in a voodoo ritual in New Orleans where he had killed his teacher to become the high priest. And by killing his teacher, he inherited all of the souls of all of the people that all of the priests in that lineage had killed, and all of the souls of all of the priests as well. So if you, the first voodoo priest kills somebody, so he gets the voodoo priest and the soul of the murdered person, and then the next one, and the next one, and the next one, and so on. And that all of them become part of his soul lineage. And that he said, "I want to give this to you. My time is almost over." So on July the 18th, Foster's nephew drove Frégère and Foster to Wisconsin. And Frégère wore overalls and a gas mask, and he aimed his gun and he shot at Foster. First bullet didn't fire. Foster was frustrated, and so he took the gun apart, put another bullet in the chamber, handed it back, and with the second shot, he died. The bullet flew out of the chamber, and that was the end of it. Frégère would claim that he received all of the souls inside of his own with him, but it didn't stop the police from arresting him or his nephew or from them going to prison. The nephew went for 4 years, Frégère for 10, and nobody knows what happened to him since then. But it is known that he did belong to a voodoo cult, and that this particular voodoo priest believed that by having himself killed and picking his protege, he could pass his soul forward and they couldn't touch his body. And at this next story, I found immensely fascinating because it is one of the very first cases, police cases in the entire country where cults and voodoo and what have you become a primary issue. And it was really strange. This is 1970, San Francisco's Golden Gate Park in California. And, you know, it's the end of the, kind of coming towards the end of the hippie thing. And the soldiers are coming back from Vietnam and all of that, right? And there's a lot of drugs and blah, blah, blah going on. So this is how kind of Golden Gate Park became kind of a mecca for all of this kind of stuff. So for the 60s and the 70s, they, the whole Haight-Ashbury area, Golden Gate area, it's kind of fallen into rough times because there's a lot of homeless people there and what have you. So in the early 1980s, there's a case that comes up. This was 1981, February the 8th of 1981, when this whole thing starts. A police officer by the name of Doherty, James Doherty, is at the precinct when a young woman walks in and she turns in a tan backpack. She said she found laying on the ground out in the park, and that it was worrisome to her because it looked like it was covered in blood. And he opened it up, and inside there were just pants and shirts with blood stains. And it was enough to make Doherty really curious as to what the heck was going on. So he thanked the young lady, and he decided to go to the place she indicated and see if he could find anything. So it's, like I said, it's a rainy, miserable day. He talks to one of the other officers. He's like, "Hey, dude, I'm going to go out there and take a look around. This much blood. There might be something happened out there. Let me see what I can find out." So he goes walking through the park, and he's really covering this area good. And he runs around to the behind some bushes and what have you eventually. And there's a sleeping bag in the rain near the lake. And there's somebody inside. You can tell it's got the lump of a person. And so he walks over and he's thinking, you know, like I said, there's a lot of homeless kids and druggies and what have you. So his first thought is to just kind of wake them up and see what's going on. As he gets close, he kind of takes the foot, he kind of taps it. And he's like, hey, You okay, dude? And then he sees the rain water running off of it. And there's a little bit of pink in it. And he walks up around and he flips the blanket up and it's a headless corpse.
Ooh.
That's all it is. It's a headless corpse. And of course you can imagine what happens next. The corpse was of a young black man. His head's missing. And it appeared to be removed by somebody who knew how to do it well, if you get what I'm saying. There weren't a lot of hesitation marks. There weren't a lot of hacking marks. They knew exactly where to go to do this quickly and thoroughly. And there's no head nearby. But as he's walking around looking for something, he comes across the headless body of a chicken and some little bits and pieces of stuff, bone and stuff that don't make any sense to him. And the head of the chicken, they would later find, had been shoved down inside the throat of the corpse.
Ooh.
Well, and there were two kernels of corn shoved down in there as well, just two. So eventually they run the prints and they come up with the fact that this is the 29-year-old man by the name of Leroy Carter. He was a Vietnam War vet. He had kind of hit hard times when he came home and he was homeless. He had been known to spend a lot of time at the Golden Gate Park. He had never really been in any trouble, petty theft, stuff like that, some drug things, but nothing violent, nothing dangerous. And everybody was really surprised. And then the detail of the mysterious headless chicken and all of this made it look more like some sort of a ritualistic killing. Well, this is way outside of the cops' league. So they start asking around and they find this police officer that they're referred to named Sandy Gallant, who is a specialist in cult brainwashing, cult witchcraft, supernatural, satanic murders, things like that. That's her thing. So she comes in, she looks at everything, and she's like, this is definitely a ritualistic murder. It has every sign. You know, you have the body laid out a specific way. You have the dead chicken, the head and all that other stuff. Like there's things at play that should be marked. So she starts asking around and she starts asking experts. And she comes across this expert in a type of magic, black magic, known as Palo Maombo. And it's a kind of an offshoot of Santeria, which is an offshoot. It's a Caribbean offshoot of the voodoo. So it's a esoteric voodoo practice, if you will. And this particular practice incorporates animal sacrifices as well as human sacrifices. And the Santeria expert comes in, takes a look, and they decide that this is definitely a Santeria murder. This is that somehow Carter had fallen, become prey to these people, that he had been killed, and that the purpose of the death was that they could use his brains, his ears, and his nose to make a magical brew that they needed to have for a specific ritual that has to sit for 21 days. And then 21 more days after the brew is made, that has to sit in the same spot where the priest is at that made it. And that this will make this ritual, this fluid, very powerful, and they can use it to their advantage. Well, you can imagine when the police hear this crazy ass theory. And not only that, but they add one more detail that's even more insane. They will have to return on the 42nd night to replace the skull back where the body had been, to give it back to this man. Okay? And the cops are literally, like, they actually, there's an interview with one of the interviews I read was with a cop that was there, and he said, our attitude was, give me a break. This stuff doesn't happen. We literally laughed at them. The 42 nights after the murder, the decomposed missing skull showed up at the site where the body had been found. The ears, the nose, the brain were all missing. And nobody had taken the chance to sit there and wait for this person. So whoever it was came and went without ever being found. This is a cold case to this day. And there is no doubt by anybody that this was a ritualistic voodoo Santeria murder. This was the case that changed the police's point of view. It's become one of the strangest cases ever investigated in San Francisco. And I was reading an article that was written where they did an interview with the woman who was the expert. And she said, and I quote, "For most of us, and I can give myself as an example, what we tended to do in the beginning was we started to hear things. And first of all, we disbelieved it. We felt guilty about disbelieving it, not realizing that there would be something there. And then from then on, perhaps a little hysterical in a way that we responded to. And hopefully we got to the point where we go, aha, I've seen both sides of this issue. And now I sit back and I'm very objective and I weigh each side and I come to the conclusion as to what reality is. I think that's where I've been for the last 3.5 years, where I'm not out trying to prove anything and I'm not necessarily trying to disprove anything. I'm trying to figure out the truth about what went on. Nobody knows to this day. Whoever did it got away." And that is my last case for the night. I think it's a fascinating subject and that we have to realize that real people, have these issues. I found at least another dozen and a half cases that are distinct and unique and modern, like in the 70s, 80s, 90s, and 2000s. So this is not something that's, a legend from 200-300 years ago or 1,000 years ago. This is something that's impacting us today. A lot of the bodies that are found, they're not stupid people, these people who practice this. They mutilate them. They make them disappear. They do all kinds of things. And sometimes they frankly don't care because they know how difficult it is for the police, even today, to believe what they're seeing, to understand that it's something more than just a crazy person and a murder. But it's part of a ritual and it's part of a process. And they go through this over and over again. That I will end for tonight. If everybody wants to hear some more stories, I certainly have them. Let us know.
And with that, good night.
Good night.